Welcome to Community Conversations. I'm Tom Michael, General Manager of Boise State Public Radio, and we're pleased to share our broadcast of a public talk by NPR reporter Kirk Siegler in March 2019 in downtown Boise for StoryFort, part of the annual TreeFort Music Fest. Kirk Siegler is on the national desk at NPR, and he's covered some of the biggest stories in the West, including many in Idaho, and recently a national story on the housing crunch in Boise. But for the past half year, he's been providing on-the-ground, behind-the-scenes coverage of the campfire in Paradise, California, the most destructive wildfire in California history. Siegler didn't just cover the November 2018 urban firestorm, which killed 85 and destroyed a densely populated town, but also covered the aftermath and the agonizing decisions about whether or not to rebuild and what the campfire means now for other American towns. His talk is called Lessons from Paradise. And here's NPR's Kirk Siegler.
Thank you so much for having me. It's great to be back in Boise. Boise. I always get that screwed up. Fortunately, not on the air. As Tom said, I've been here quite a bit, covering some timber issues, covering some housing crunch issues. Crunch, maybe putting it lightly. On my beat, typically I cover rural America and I cover the Western U.S. for NPR. And rural America and everything going on in rural America is woven very tightly into what's happening in Paradise, Paradise, California. Actually, out of curiosity, has anybody been there? Okay, more than I thought. I had never been there. I'd been to Chico. You almost don't even know if you've been to the Central Valley of California, right where the Central Valley starts becoming a little bit more narrow in what's called real Northern California, the North State. It's a largely rural area. If you travel through Chico, a lot of farms, a college town, you almost might not even notice that Paradise is up there or even know that it's up there. It's frequently billed as a town, this kind of mountain town. But what it really is or was a whole city, you know, 27,000 people, literally decimated overnight. 90% of its housing stock gone in a matter of hours. So we were trying to think of something to call this talk. We call it the Lessons from Paradise. But what we really have been trying to get at with NPR's coverage, with my coverage, with our ongoing coverage is to answer the question, is Paradise going to be a game changer? So is it going to force us to rethink how we respond to disasters, in particular wildfires, and the sort of push to rebuild and put everything back the way it was? And does that make sense? So I apologize up front if I'm going to be asking a lot of questions, but frankly, there are a lot of questions. And by the way, there will be time for questions from you guys because I understand you already have some. If something is burning, maybe we'll break because what I'm about to talk about is a little dense. That's not a way to pitch for you guys to keep your attention, but there are a lot of issues at stake here. So let me give you a quick little snapshot of what it was like to go up there. Right here in this photo, you can see the commercial district. And when you cover wildfires in California, it's a little bit different than what I'm used to covering wildfires for the that are federally managed on Forest Service land or BLM land, Bureau of Land Management land. In California, there's a liberal open access, open media access law. So if the state is managing the fire, we are allowed right on in there, almost to the point where it could be a little dicey. I got the assignment to go up there. I had covered a lot of fires from around California, from my home state of Montana, my adopted home state of Colorado, Washington State, Arizona. So it's almost like I'd been sort of desensitized to covering these things. But I will tell you that when I got up there, I was shocked. It's not about me, but the level of destruction is horrific. And it continues to be 5 months on. A couple colleagues of mine who have covered conflict overseas likened it to a war zone, seeing, you know, stuff that, you know, after bombs have gone off in Raqqa. It's a lot to see. And it's a lot to take in. Thousands of homes wiped out, incinerated. The Safeway obliterated, Rite Aid. And this wasn't really a mountain town. This is like a whole suburban place built out into the woods. The WUI. You guys know what that is, right? I know I've got an Idaho audience, but the Wildland Urban Interface. This was a urban wildfire. It was not a forest fire like we grew up with, like I remember in Yellowstone in 1988. This was a urban wildfire of which we are seeing more and more of. As a correspondent on the national desk, we go to a lot of these things. Like I said, nothing as big as this, but I'd come a little desensitized, but also a little cynical about having to keep going into natural disasters, natural in air quotes, I guess, in this case, but we'll get to that in a minute, and leaving, like having to leave and not staying and fully seeing it through. So I pitched that this one's different. I think we should stay and follow this through because there's a lot at stake. Is paradise going to be the turning point? Are we going to continue down the status quo? Because we know there's going to be a next paradise. And should we rebuild paradise? These are questions that are being asked right now. Largely, to be frank, outside of paradise. When you go up there right now and ask that question in paradise, you might imagine what the response is among those who are left, because many people have left. And that's the tension. That's among the tensions. Because paradise, sure, there were a lot of people who moved up there because they wanted a little slice of the country. They wanted to live in the Sierra Nevada foothills. It's rather mild. It's not as hot as being down in the Central Valley. There are big trees. There's a lot of foliage. It's very pretty. It snows sometimes, but not too bad. But there's a whole segment of the population who has to live up there because there is nowhere else to live for people on fixed incomes, people who don't have a lot of money. That is also the story of paradise, and that is the tension going forward. So if we're not going to rebuild, or even if we are going to rebuild a town like this, what about all the lower-income people living there, the seniors in fixed income who lived in those mobile home parks who you've no doubt read about, or maybe you know of them, because some have been relocated to places like this, to this valley. The unfortunate 85 or so who died in this fire, some couldn't get out of those places because they didn't have cars. But it was a place you could live and maybe live on a Social Security, $900 a month. You can't do that in most of California. But the Sierra Nevada foothills are one place you can. I've been talking a lot about California, but this is the case all across Idaho, Oregon, the Northwest in particular, which used to be rather wet and appears to be drying out when you look in the long term. So there are bigger national implications from this wildfire in paradise and how it's, you know, exposed and sort of peeled back this housing crisis that already existed that you guys know something, a little something about here. And unfortunately, you may be able to picture a community in Idaho that could very well be in a situation just like paradise. A rural community that doesn't have the resources that even a city in an aggregate sense like Houston and Harvey, they can't absorb this kind of crisis. And overnight, 15, almost 20,000 people become refugees. And that's what they're openly called there, refugees. It's also openly called frequently a slow disaster to unfold like a rural Katrina, in the sense that these are many people who were on the margins economically already, whose situation is even more exacerbated by the fire. And if we're not careful, we will forget about them, especially in this seemingly manic news cycle. So I've been staying up there for the good part of early 2019. This is a photo of my colleague, Eric Westervelt. You may know him from covering Iraq. He's now on our desk here in the West. I'm just going to play this soundbite.
And I lost everything, including what my dad gave me. Every time I talk about it, it just hurts. Yeah, it hurts so bad.
So this is Cynthia Davis. She was staying in the Red Cross shelter at the Chico Fairgrounds. I'm happy to report that she's no longer staying there. She did get access to a FEMA trailer. But she and her husband and her, I think the couple's 18-year-old son, spent about 3 months living in their camper in the parking lot of the Red Cross shelter, which at one point was a tent city. And when you go back there right now, there are still probably 100 or so, the last time I checked in, people living there. So you can see she's in crisis. She didn't have a lot of resources to begin with, and now she has even less. But the federal government is paying to get her a trailer. The federal government will pay to put her in a hotel. To some extent, disasters work slightly different in the state of California because it's the most populous state. There are different laws. There are different environmental laws. There are overlapping situations. So in California, the state does pay probably a bit more when it comes to disasters than your average state. But even in California, 75% or so of the money is federal going to these things. So what could we learn from Paradise? So one thing we're trying to get at through our reporting, and I apologize if I'm jumping around on you a little bit here, but we're trying to get a sense for what in our disaster response infrastructure needs to be changed. In other words, is it out of whack? We come in after the wildfire, the flood, the hurricane, in particular in this case, the wildfire, kind of a mix of climate factors, forest management issues, wildfire suppression, and an explosion of home development into the fire-prone forests. We come in, and all of our mechanisms, for the most part, are geared toward getting people like Cynthia Davis back into her house as quickly as possible. So is that what we want to do? There's a couple more photos here of destruction. This one was kind of a famous photo. Not this photo in particular, but I think you might have seen. This gives a sense for the I don't know, the urban nature of the fire. This photo is, I took this photo. It's often sort of heartbreaking because you can sort of see that this person clearly was trying to get out when the fire came through. It looked like they were, if we were able to zoom out, looked like they were able to, they were trying to take a three-point turnaround. We can only hope that somebody drove by and they were able to get in. There are just some harrowing stories of people getting out of, you know, five-hour gridlock traffic evacuations with flames going on either side in a town that was poorly planned, only incorporated in 1978, however, had been there for more than 100 years, which had so many one-way, too many one-way-in, one-way-out streets to even count, and really only a couple thoroughfares that you could even get out of. I mean, and people there in post-game call it poorly planned. When you drive around Paradise and the community above it, Magalia, and see some of the places that didn't burn, it's pretty alarming. I mean, as somebody who's covered a lot of wildfires and urban wildfires now, the streets will, you know, you're up in the woods, but you've got a whole city, and the streets will wind down, and there'll be five, six houses packed there, then maybe a mobile home unit, no egress, not really any, to speak of, water infrastructure, just something that just grew and grew and grew, which I probably don't have to tell you about as a thing, in particularly in the rural West, where we have very libertarian-leaning values when it comes to zoning. A lot of people like Nicholas Soto, who was already living in an RV that you can see right there in this photo. That's where he lived before the fire.
We fled the fire only to jump into hell.
So he, Nicholas Soto, is still living at that Red Cross shelter, which, by the way, was supposed to close. He's got health issues. His wife does as well, and there aren't really any means to get out. Their RV was damaged during the escape, and He's been having a hard time getting somebody to come into the Red Cross shelter to fix it. That's another thing. There was already a housing shortage before the wildfire. There was also already a labor shortage. There aren't enough contractors. There aren't enough, you know, service workers in these communities. And if they are working, they're working 24/7. He's got a plan, hopefully, to get up to Oregon. He's going to move. A lot of people who could leave Paradise have left. A lot of older people who have thrown up their hands and said, we're so lucky we survived, but we are basically not going to, you know. I talked to one guy who's 86, and he said, you know, by the time we maybe rebuild in several years, or if this town even comes back, you know, I don't have many years left. So they, if they had the means and the insurance, they packed up and left. There are a lot of people who you might talk to as well, who say politically this was the sign. You know, we're hearing about, not to get off into too much of a diversion, but we're hearing about people kind of clustering with their political values. This was a very conservative place for the most part. You know, the county went overwhelmingly for Trump. I don't know how many people, you know, clearly in the, you know, of the survivors voted for him or even think about politics, but people say that they're leaving California because they don't like the political atmosphere, and this was maybe a way, the way to push them out. Now, that said, there are a lot of people who still want to be in Paradise and want to see it rebuilt, even amid all these other questions. This is a photo of the more of that camp. I'll show another one of these photos here in a second, but there's a little bit of irony there. This is a church that puts up that has put up all these inspirational signs when you drive around Paradise. Now, this photo here, you can see, I don't know how if you can see it that well, but it's basically stacks of cars. And over here is a, I think, an old market that had been there since the 30s. Now, this photo was taken just a couple of weeks ago. So this gives you a sense for the level of destruction and how much work has to be done to even clean up the town, let alone talk about rebuilding. I'm going to play a little soundbite here from a behavioral scientist who studies communities' responses to natural disasters and is a large advocate for what she calls hitting the pause button. Whereas when we have these disasters, it tends to be our human nature to, I mean, I can't fault, I've never been in this situation, but I can imagine I might think the same way. I want to somehow return to normal. These are traumatized people who have been through hell, as Nicholas Soto said, who have had loved ones die, who almost died themselves. Maybe someday I'll come back and talk about something a little bit more uplifting. I apologize. So there is a little bit of optimism, though.
The recovery period after a devastating disaster is also an opportunity to rethink what you want your community to be like.
This is something that Paradise is doing right now. They've begun launching into these large-scale community forums to ask people who are left there and maybe people who are still living in the region who want to come back, well, what they want to see out of their town. And these forums have been very interesting. I will say as a caveat, though, in the immediate weeks after the fire, despite what Kathleen Tierney at the Hazard Center at the university says, we watched Pacific Gas and Electric, PG&E, the cable companies, the phone companies, race to put all of the utility lines, or at least many of the utility lines, right back up on the same streets that don't have any egress, on the same streets that were built in a certain way without a lot of planning, because we were, as Kathleen Tierney puts it, that sort of instinct to put things back as they were instead of hitting that pause button. You know, when you watch those things go back up like that, that's how our disaster infrastructure response system works. Like, well, can you just imagine what the fallout would be if PG&E, there's a lot of fallout on PG&E right now, but we won't go into that. But can you just imagine if they hadn't put that stuff up? It's kind of a chicken and egg. Well, what, you don't want us to be able to rebuild? You can't rebuild unless you put the stuff back up. PG&E, incidentally, has told me that they can easily put it back down and reconfigure it. But the point being, even if the town wanted to redesign its streets in a safer way, there are certain forces already working against it. We're already putting things back, in some ways. But for who? There's nobody up there. And then you've got FEMA. It's FEMA's stated mission, and FEMA does a lot of good, to be clear, but it's their mission to get in and out of natural disasters in about an 18-month window. It's their stated goal to make it as easy as possible for everyone who wants to go back in to rebuild to do so. But this comes back to the question, the central question, should we be encouraging people to rebuild in these high-risk zones? What do you guys think of that? I mean, because what if it happens here? It could happen here, right? I personally live in Los Angeles, so if I were to go up to Paradise and say, well, should you rebuild? They'll be like, well, should you live in LA? You live right on a fault line. But the point being, these disasters are becoming more and more frequent, more intense. The scale of them, the destruction. FEMA has spent more than $50 million, FEMA alone, right now in Butte County, California. This fire destroyed 19,000 structures, including about 13,000 or so homes, 90% of the entire town of Paradise, also some of the rural areas around it, completely decimated. Kathleen Tierney says, we may be able to slow down the losses, but we can't stop them. This is the legacy, and this is the bill that has come through. That has come due, sorry. So typically, looks like I just threw my paper down there. I hope I don't need that. Typically after a fire, we will see, and I've covered a lot of this. Oh, thank you. I've covered a lot of this. We have a big fire in an area, and people have been through a lot, and they will ask and frankly demand of their government to make it easier for them to rebuild, speed up the building permit process. After you've endured so much trauma, it's the least you can do, right? But given the conditions out there with this huge amount of development going on in the wildland-urban interface, there's a think tank up in Montana called Headwaters Economics that has been warning and warning and warning that a huge amount of the wildland-urban interface, we talk about all this explosion of development in it, but a huge amount of it has yet to be developed and could be developed because there's no real disincentive right now to not develop because we do have the federal government coming in to shoulder the bulk of the costs when these disasters hit. Local county commissions face the threat of being sued by developers. The land use codes, the zoning restrictions, maybe they aren't where they are. So I'm posing a lot of questions here. It's not my job as a reporter to tell you how it is or how it should be. It's our job to raise these questions. So we talked about the explosion of home development. Talk about the history of wildfire suppression. You all know about that. You're sitting in the community with the NFC. Probably some of you work there. So I'm, a lot of good work, a lot of people in the fire world, and I dare say a lot of people in this room probably weren't as surprised as the general public with this enormous tragedy happened because people have been warning about this for years. It was billed right after the effect by certain media outlets who don't necessarily have the attention to detail as we do or the in-depth coverage that we do, quickly labeling this one thing, not enough logging or climate refugees. Well, it's more, I guess I had that backwards, left than right. It's a little bit more complex than that, as you all know, probably. You've got a history of fire suppression. You've got overgrown forests. You've got a fact where the actual development in these forests actually becomes the fuel for the fire to jump from one thing to the next. It's an urban fire. And then you've got climate. Paradise, This would be the envy of everybody in this room, right? Paradise typically would get something like 50 inches of rain a year. And it, as luck would have it, this past winter, it seems they got most of that all at once. But leading up to the fire, excuse me, the fall rains just didn't come. Had they have come like a week or so later, maybe this wouldn't have happened, but it may have happened the next year. So climate is also the big factor. So you've got three big different things here, or intertwined things going together. So can we change this? Can we figure out how to prevent situations like this? A lot of people think we can't prevent situations like this, but we may be able to mitigate them. You know, I said the development keeps happening in these high-risk zones, not just for fires. We also just don't have enough housing, so we're putting housing in these places. In some cases, it tends to be more affordable. And the other thing is this sort of notion, and we've been reporting this out, and this what I'm kind of not using you guys, sorry, but I'm sort of getting my thoughts together, presenting this to a group, because you will hear probably in another month or so on NPR about a 20-minute piece looking at all these things and trying to answer these questions. What needs to change? What in our disaster recovery infrastructure has to change? And can you even change it? You know, it's kind of remarkable being in Paradise right now, watching the disaster industry descend on it. Whether it be FEMA, there are many, many dedicated, hardworking federal employees that move from one disaster to the next. There are disaster cleanup companies hiring locals to do the work. There's a lot of money tied up in the disaster recovery industry. One source dubbed it the disaster industrial complex. This is hard to change. The cleanup that has to happen in Paradise that really only just begun a couple weeks ago is on a scale that the country has not seen since 9/11. And by cleanup, I'm talking about the not just the hauling away of the ash, but they have to clear all of the topsoils. They have to take out all of the chimneys, all of the foundations, all of the structures, all of the cars. And every time you go back up there on the ridge, as it's called, it's shocking to see how much more work still has to be done. They also have to move upwards of they have to get out upwards of a million trees. So it's going to take a lot of money, time, and resources to do that. And there's a lot of money tied up in this. And then there's also the question of, where can you go in the world where there is no risk? As the mayor of Paradise, Jody Jones, told me many times.
Paradise has been there since the 1850s. This never happened before. So it was a perfect storm, and it's not a reason to say no one should ever live there again. Where can you go in the world that you have no risk?
She has a point, right? I just mentioned we all live in high-risk zones. I was talking glibly there about how Paradise, you know, this is a pretty weighty topic, and, you know, it's very relevant and timely, and unfortunately, we know there's going to be another Paradise, and we keep seeing these disasters get worse and worse and worse to the next one. Couldn't believe that. Now we can't believe this. But there is some hope in Paradise, and as the mayor will tell you, that photo I took there just recently, she's at one of these community forums I talked about. Excuse me. They're trying to get it right. They want to rebuild a resilient town. They want to build a town that is as safe as possible against any kind of disaster. But, you know, up there it's either mudslides or fires. And then occasionally a tornado in the valley. I sometimes joke, dark humor here, that California doesn't have weather, it just has calamities, which is sort of true. There'll be a fire, and then 5 days later, it rains 6 inches. This is all getting worse, by the way, with climate change. As every climate scientist They won't necessarily tell you that this one event can be pinpointed on climate change, but it's an example of a bigger story that's been happening and unfolding and what we need to prepare for. So the mayor and others, when they go to these forums, there are some, it is democracy in action. And sometimes it's really, really messy. There are a lot of conspiracy theorists crashing meetings. There are a lot of right-wing conspiracy people. But there are also a lot of dedicated people, not to say that the other people on the other side aren't dedicated, but people who want to rebuild their town in a way that could be more safe from fires. There's a lot of research out there that shows not just defensible space, but even the stuff that you do right around your home, not just the brush clearing, but the needles in the gutter, the needles on the wood shingles that you shouldn't maybe have. Paradise also exposed just how old our housing stock is. So people talk about California is much more progressive than the rest of the West when it comes to statewide policy on building codes and fire-resistant areas and development in the WUI, but that only applies to new building. So a lot of houses up there were old. People didn't have the money to... They were having other crises, or they weren't thinking about it, or they didn't have the money to do these kinds of things. But we're learning more and more out of this. There are ways to rebuild in a way that can save homes. And in fact, even in this horrific fire, you can go up there and see a few houses that were spared. Sometimes it's totally chance. You can't do anything, but their fire scientists are looking at certain homes that had certain things done to them and different types of building codes and had done a little bit more around them, and they were spared. So there are ways to do this, says the mayor and others. And they've hired a firm that did the consulting for the state of Louisiana after Katrina. And when you go to these forums, in fact, I think there might even be one going on this evening. We should all go. But... people, there's resounding people saying, we want to see better streets, more access points, better emergency routes, redesigned streets, you know, maybe tougher building codes. But you also see people raising the issue of gentrification. So you're going to build this new town. It's going to be top of the line. It's going to be a national model of climate resiliency. And who's going to be able to live there? Wealthy people from San Francisco. So that's the balance that a town like Paradise has to make. They are not going to not rebuild, at least they say at this point. The town has made town council has passed a declaration saying that. It's interesting when I travel around and talk to people outside of Paradise, you often get, well, they shouldn't rebuild. But in Paradise, for the most part, the people who are back are pretty committed to it happening. Now, we'll see how long this drags on. The good news is they have maybe a year or more to even start planning this, because they're going to be, like I said, the hazardous debris removal is going to take so long that they do have some time to think about this. We'll get to questions here. This is another photo I took just the other day. This is the Safeway. And I show these, the only slide up here that I have, as I mentioned earlier, that was actually in the moment of the fire, or basically a couple days after the worst of it. Most of these photos are pretty contemporary, which gives you a sense for, the amount of work that has to be done up there and what it looks like even now, 5 months, after the wildfire. This is one corner of a shopping center. I mean, you can see the what were the carts there stacked up. And then down the road, there's a Kmart that's still intact. And there are some businesses that are reopening. But it's not clear how sustainable that's going to be, because most people don't live there. And people whose homes were spared were the, quote, lucky ones. Some of them have survivor's guilt. Others don't want to live there because of the trauma they've been through. Some are committed to staying there for now. But can you just imagine living in a decimated neighborhood with your house still standing with no community left? There are a lot of volunteers. This man I always go up and check in on when I'm up there. This is a little bit farther up the road from Paradise. They've got a, I think they're working, it's an NGO, it's a Baptist church. I guess it's not an NGO, but in this case it's a de facto NGO that's partnering with the government to distribute water. The town of, when you stand out there, for the people who are left, and some of them are camping illegally on their properties. I say illegally because they haven't been cleaned up yet, which is a whole other issue. But they have nowhere else to go because there are no hotels in Chico. There's no housing. And there's no water in Paradise. The town's water supply is completely compromised. There are benzenes that have seeped into it from all of the toxins that burned. These aren't your average forest fires, remember, like when we were kids? These are urban fires burning lead paint and all kinds of horrific things. So when you stand out here, it's amazing to watch how fast these pallets of water. I mean, I interviewed Dwayne here for about 10 minutes, and that entire pallet was distributed while we were standing there, just people talking or people driving up in need. So Dwayne's one of the people I haven't hesitated to just ask, you know, the blunt questions.
How do you rebuild an entire city from the ground up? We don't know.
Should it be rebuilt?
You know, probably.
So, the end. No. But, you know, these are tough questions, right? Should we rebuild it? Well, if we don't rebuild it, what do we do? And what do we do about the next Paradise? I don't want to name names, but I've been to a few places recently and done stories about fire risks. So I'll just name names. Spokane, Washington comes to mind. Whitefish, Montana. The suburbs of Salt Lake City and the Wasatch Front. And for that matter, most of the foothills of the Sierra Nevada, in particular Grass Valley and some of the foothill communities above Sacramento. Places where there used to be a lot of rain and a huge amount of foliage growing up and not a lot of attention to brush clearing and that kind of thing. And even in some cases in the West, as you probably know, there are ordinances and HOA rules that require people to keep a certain amount of trees to maintain that mountain look or that rural lifestyle. We moved up to Paradise because we didn't want to live in the city. We like these trees. We like having all of this around, all of this nature. There are two slides left. I know you've all been dying to know what it where a reporter would live in the Paradise area when I've just laid out that there's no housing. We were fortunate enough to have a friend of a friend of somebody who knew somebody who had a shed that was converted into a guest house that they used to, that they usually just have their family stay in, but they recognized the need of the need for workforce housing, for people coming in to work on the fire. So they converted it quickly and turned it into an Airbnb. So if you've heard any of, my coverage from there, chances are it was filed right behind that little umbrella. There are also many, many critters that join the reporter every evening. This is a walnut grove. This is the back house of the walnut grove. And I'm just trying to make it a little light here because we've been talking about such a dense subject, but I do feel a little bad even, and I'm by no means complaining about where I was staying or have been staying, because so many people have been through so many other things. But in this area alone, in the orchards and groves outside of Chico, on this property, the couple, there's a house in front of this property where the couple lives, who are great and who are like longtime community leaders and know everybody. And one of them works at the local weekly and is entrenched. They, at one point while I was staying there, they also allowed a woman to park her RV in the back. I don't have a photo of that, but right behind there in the back. She's a teacher, lost her job or lost her home in Paradise. School was relocated down into Chico, and she's now living on their walnut grove in their RV. Across the road, there's a CSA farm. There are three, at one point there were three campers out there that they were being allowed to camp on the on the farm. When you go through Chico, you see RVs parked in streets, basically anywhere possible. And the beauty is you can chop wood when you've had a really tough edit or you've been in a long editorial meeting and you need to burn off some steam. That's me. So we'll leave it there. I'm not going to leave it on that photo. Do you think this is a good time to start some questions, maybe? Okay.
Yeah, I think this is a great time.
Do we have questions?
Yeah, I think we probably will have a lot of questions. And just to say, for those folks who are in the middle of the aisle, I'll pass the microphone. And Joe, I think, also has a microphone over on that side. But, you know, try to keep your questions short. Go ahead and say your name and where you're from before you ask your questions. So hands up if you've got a question. I see one right here.
Gary Richardson. I live in the Boise foothills next to the Fort Boise Military Reserve. And I wanted to ask, was there a FireWise program going on in Paradise before the fire? We've had a few very close misses. I think we lost one person a few years ago in Columbia Village. But we do have now a pretty active FireWise program, and I think that's helping those of us who do live on that wooey.
They do. The answer is yes, they do. In fact, they have fire. I think this is a California, unique to California, not concept, but term, fire safe councils that are set up through CAL FIRE, the State Department of Fire, that do that kind of work, that were doing that kind of work in Paradise and had done a fair amount of work. And in Paradise, as you probably heard, some of the news reports showed that they had just had a practice emergency drill to evacuate the town not long before the campfire. They do have a fairly active FireWise community. It does not reach everyone, though, as has been exposed by this tragedy. They had a big fire in 2008, back when we thought big fires were the fires that destroyed 100 houses, or I can't even remember covering a wildfire. I can remember, it seems so strange now, but I can remember being put on a plane really quickly. I put myself on the plane, but responding to a wildfire in Colorado Springs that burned 500 houses and killed two people. And frankly, the sad reality is that I don't know that we would cover that as much right now, just because we have to balance our resources and we're having to cover things like this. But they did have that. They didn't have it enough, I think people will say. There are a lot of people there who want to do the right thing and are trying to keep this very much in the eye of the public. It was like a couple months ago, an eerie newspaper article, the local weekly dug up a story that they had done 25 years ago about a practice session of a mock situation where a deadly fire hit the ridge and killed hundreds of people. And that was 25 years ago. And so to be provocative and to get his discussion going, the paper decided just to print that article verbatim, and the parallels were chilling. So yes, I think the answer is they did have a FireWise community, fire safe councils. California does do a lot. I don't think California and Californians will tell you they don't do enough. And the other thing real quick to that is, could you do anything? People have told me that they saw where the fire, you know, there was reports of the fire that morning. It was 30 miles away. So they thought, okay, we'll be ready to evacuate if we need to, but that's 30 miles away. It's pretty far away. And then within a couple of hours, it's within a mile of the town and then in the town. So it moves so fast.
Hi, my name's Laura. I'm originally from Chico. I went to high school there and college, and my mom lived in Chico for Paradise for 25 years and did lose her home. She lost her home.
Sorry.
So as far as the notification, there was none. There was no reverse 911. The fire came on. It was a perfect storm. It came on so fast that nobody had time to call each other. Nobody had time to... She called 911, and they just said, get out. There was somewhat of a FireWise community. However, this fire just obliterated everybody. Her neighbor across the street, perfect yard, cleared all the time, gone. Her neighbor behind her, cars everywhere, brush everywhere, was saved. So this fire had, it was just, it was random. It was a perfect storm in that it was a very windy day. And like you said, the egress and ingress of getting into town was very difficult. There's one long sky, it was called the Skyway. It goes up the road, up into the ridge, and everybody was flooding down there at once. So, and to speak about recovery, she is 78 years old. She's not going to rebuild. Most of the community was senior. They aren't going to rebuild. They're too old. They're not going to wait around for that. Her property is going to be cleared in the next week or so, only because she had really good insurance. But for her to rebuild and relocate to get something comparable, she's going to have a struggle.
So what's she going to do? Does she know?
She doesn't know. And most of the people that have been experienced by this fire, they don't know either. You know, you talk to any of the survivors and you ask them that question, what are you going to do? They're still in a state of shock. They have a lot of, my mom has post-traumatic stress syndrome. She wakes up in the middle of the night and she feels like her house is on fire. So, you know, it's affected her and, you know, it's affected me too. It was a very tight-knit community. She lost a couple friends in the fire. So it's a devastation that could happen anywhere. It could happen in McCall, easy. It could happen in Boise Foothills. It was just the perfect storm.
Thank you for your comment, and sorry about that. Where is she staying right now? Is she with you? Oh, okay. I'm sorry I mentioned that. reporters do a lot of gallows humor, I apologize. Just because we see a lot. I was actually surprised by how much this affected me personally. I cover a lot of mass shootings. I've been to earthquakes abroad, a volcano abroad, and a lot of disasters. And people in tough situations, but I hadn't seen anything like this ever when it comes to a wildfire. There are stories about one guy told me, broke down after he wanted to tell me for an hour his exact, just to basically for therapeutic purposes, he said, to just recount to him, he'd only told his daughter this story, exactly what happened to him that day. But it's interesting you mentioned that. I mean, he had a harrowing escape like so many others. But he mentioned that his 86-year-old neighbor was asleep and maybe didn't have a cell phone or wasn't registered for reverse 911s. And he kicked down the door to wake him up when he was finally getting out of there, and he's pretty sure he survived. There are others who weren't as fortunate. So another question back there.
Hi, my name is Melissa. I'm from Missoula, Montana. I wrote my question down. How do you balance reporting this story as fully and as truthfully as you can, while also minimizing harm to these people who have been through an incredibly traumatic event?
Excellent question. It's a work in progress. We fortunately do not have the pressures, at least the perceived pressures, I think, watching, you know, network TV reporters with a producer screaming in their ear to go stick a mic in front of somebody. But it's tough. There are a lot of people, in particular after this disaster, who wanted to talk. There are some who just don't, and you just let them, give them space. I mean, some people are willing to talk because it maybe helps them, or they're in shock, like you mentioned, or, you know, certainly we don't want to be talking to people who are in shock and don't realize they're talking to us. But, you know, we are human, too. Sometimes, you know, the old school journalist whose guard is like this and I don't have any emotions. But, you know, we can show empathy. I might tell them that I've been to a lot of fires and covered a lot of fires and hadn't seen anything like this, and I can't even imagine what you're going through. I'm so sorry for your losses. But yeah, it's a tricky thing. I don't think it's our responsibility as journalists to be in a situation like that, trying to do gotcha style journalism or, you know, jumping right to the question of, well, why'd you live up there? I mean, did you know this was going to happen? Those are questions for later. But yeah, it's a difficult thing. I mean, I used to think that, you know, covering natural disasters, maybe that air quote again in this situation to some extent, are a little bit better than covering the mass shooting or other sorts of violence that seemingly could have been prevented. But this one was different. I mean, this one was the scale of this and so many people in anguish and, like you say today, so many people traumatized. And what we're learning more about post-traumatic stress is that this could be triggered anytime. You know, maybe in 3 years. So it's a difficult question to answer, and it's probably still a work in progress. But I mean, balancing is difficult, but I think it's our job to get out there and tell the story of what's happening, hopefully in the most informed way possible without making a lot of judgments. I've covered the rural West in particular for a number of years, so I can probably parachute in quicker than the most and get a sense for a place because I've been to a lot of places like this. But don't rush to too many judgments about things. You don't know what the community's like. And I also worry as well that our listeners are getting disaster fatigue. I mean, how much bad news do you want to hear? My editor and I had this conversation because the people that you meet, that I've noticed more in this disaster than others, but the amount of tragedy that many people in certain situations that I was discussing, the amount of tragedy they've had before this or just piled on is staggering. I mean, I went up to, while I was up there in February, it's interesting, it's kind of sort of similar to becoming a local reporter again. All of the national media, for the most part, has left, and I'm just here. So I'm going to meetings like the other local reporters. And, you know, you meet a lot of people, and one woman who's been following stuff from the county is like, you really ought to go up to this community called Concow, which had a wildfire 10 years ago. It was largely, you know, was very much impacted, and they've been feeling sort of short shrift in the media attention afterwards. Like, everybody's been on Paradise because that's where the worst crises is, but Concow is also a tough hit. So I went up there. There was literally nobody around but utility crews. A little bit more of a situation like we might think of as a wildfire. It was in a forest. The forest is charred. Houses have been burned, but it wasn't a full city. And the only person I could find who looked like he was a homeowner, who wasn't a disaster response person, was down with his son in this kind of like hollow area, clearing out some blackened bushes that had been charred. They were trying to clear them out and put them in a pile that I presume they were going to slash burn or something. And he, very agreeable guy, very friendly guy, very sad guy. You know, his son was, he's a full-time caregiver of his son, developmentally disabled, who's with him. He's about 19. He said, well, look up on maybe somebody heard this story. It was on Weekend Edition a couple weeks ago. We debated about whether or not we should even air this because the story is so tragic, and do we want to hear all this? In the end, obviously, it aired under the thinking that people need to know about this stuff. He gestured up to his what was the house up there on the hill. There's some burned-out cars around it. And he said, well, we can go take a look. This was my dad's place, and it actually burned to the ground in 2008. And so we had a mobile home up there, and then that burned in the campfire, and unfortunately my father burned in it. This man also lost his house in Paradise. So the amount of tragedy hitting one community at once, and many people who are already dealing with a lot of issues is really something. So when you see signs about the best is yet to come, or, you know, Paradise strong or Ridge strong, it's like, well, they're hoping something better is ahead. And like I said, I think there is some hope that that you feel in the community? I mean, it's really been kind of one thing after another, crisis, crisis, crisis. Oh, we can maybe do this. Nope, you can't do this. This setback, this one. But there is some hope that they, for those who have the time and resources to maybe stick around and ride it out, they may be able to rebuild a place that could become a model for the West, if not even the country, because we're seeing pretty bad fires now in the Southeast like we haven't seen before. So a lot of attention is going to be on Paradise, and we hope to keep the spotlight on it because we're kind of in this, as it's been told to me, we're in this sort of unsustainable path. Like at some point, the federal government is not going to be able to come in and take care of this situation. So we've got to have to change something. I'd be interested in what you guys think we need to change. But are there other questions?
I have a quick one really fast, just because you're talking about the editorial process a little bit. What were those conversations like with the NPR editors about, hey, I think I should stay? Because, I mean, you're kind of a breaking news guy. You kind of do everything. What was that like when you said, you know, I think I should stay?
Do you want the real story no, okay.
Real story, please.
Actually, it was a pretty easy sell because NPR has a pretty proven track record of doing this. We did it after Katrina. In particular, Adrian Florido, who's in my office in LA, has spent the past year or more in Puerto Rico after Maria. So it's actually been a pretty easy sell. And the idea behind embedding is that you're actually really figuring out what's going on. It's like old school reporting, and there's more hunger for that now than ever. When you lay it all out like this, it's a pretty easy, yeah, we should do this, because when are we going to learn? Otherwise, we're just going to keep going to all these fires and not doing in-depth coverage and maybe not informing the public, and that's our public service as journalists, right?
Hi, my name's Catherine, and I live in Boise. But I have a question about just looking at it historically, and I know there's been this uptick in the last, 10 years or whatever with fires and floods and whatnot, but I can't help but think of the Great Chicago Fire and the fire that happened just north of there in Wisconsin the same or the next day that never even got covered. And is there any use in looking at, obviously those are formed for different reasons, but Chicago rebuilt itself kind of with that in mind, and that was probably 150 years ago.
Bricks?
Yeah, right, with bricks instead of wooden sidewalks. Yeah. But yeah, just a thought about Chicago.
Well, I think, and I'm afraid to say with such surety, but the other fire you're talking about in Wisconsin, when we reference the Camp Fire being the deadliest, most destructive wildfire in the U.S. in modern times, it's since that fire. So we have had bad wildfires. I don't know how much you can compare it. Who knows if the town had not been built out of wood, all wood in those days. Maybe that had a hand in it. Maybe the climactic conditions were such back then. I don't know. But yes, it's an important question to look at the record because we are we are also in this moment of, oh my God, everything's so awful, 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 awful. And there's no real kind of put back or look back to, well, something like this has actually happened before, the 1910 fires, like when I grew up. When I grew up, I heard about the 1910 fires. We'd go hiking behind where we grew up in Missoula and go hiking up into the burned areas, and you could still see remnants of the 1910 fires. This was like 1916 when we went hiking. But we've had bad fires like this before. Have we had the same climactic conditions and the same amount of development and the same situation in our forest? I don't know. But yes, those questions are actually being asked. I think there's one more question back in the back, but I don't know if there's time.
We're running low on time, I'm afraid. But thank you so much, Kirk.
Thank you.
Huge round of applause.
You've been listening to a Boise State Public Radio Community Conversation, featuring NPR reporter Kirk Siegler, recorded in front of an audience at Storyfort on March 21st, 2019 in downtown Boise. You can find other community conversations at boisestatepublicradio.org. Select the Programs tab and choose Community Conversations.